South America is a diverse continent with many different ecological zones, but it is dominated down the entire length of the western coast by the mighty Andes Mountains, which stretch for 4,500 miles from north to south, the longest mountain range on Earth. The Andes were created by plate tectonic movements, essentially the lighter oceanic crust of the Nazca tectonic plate that lies at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean slid eastwards under the continental crust of the South American plate, forcing up two parallel mountain ranges about 60 miles wide. The average elevation for the Andes is around 13,000 feet, but some peaks rise to 22,000 feet. So this is a huge mountain barrier that has a significant influence on the climate and environment of much of the continent. One key example of this is that the Andes prevent the prevailing winds that blow across South America from the east from reaching the narrow west coast strip. So while many regions east of the Andes are wet and feature tropical rainforests, the west coast is a desert most of the time. The Atacama Desert, which stretches along the northern coast of Chile, is officially the driest non-polar region on Earth. At some weather stations, no rainfall has ever been recorded. Yet incredibly, despite its hyper-aridity, ancient human communities learned to live in the Atacama Desert and used its extreme environment to create the world's oldest known mummies, human bodies preserved to be used in various rituals. The mummies were created by the Chinchorro people, and they predate the Egyptian mummies by 2,000 years. Around 250 desiccated mummies have been found, dating from as early as 5,800 BCE, their limbs stiffened with wooden planks. Aridity is not the only environmental problem the West Coast faces. Earthquakes caused by moving tectonic plates rock the region frequently. And the prevailing ocean current along the coast, the Humboldt Current, which usually runs south to north, reverses direction and flows north to south a couple of times a decade in response to an El Niño event, bringing torrential rains. In the heart of the Andes, along the mountains and thin coastal strip occupied by the modern nations of Peru and Bolivia, early foraging communities learned to survive by exploiting extensive marine resources. Eventually, perhaps from as early as 5000 BCE, these foragers made the transition to agriculture, learning to cultivate corn, beans, peanuts, and sweet potatoes, as well as cotton, which grew in the wild in both Afro-Eurasia and the Americas, and was used to make textiles. As these early agrarian societies became more complex, more sophisticated irrigation systems were constructed, along with some impressively large buildings. Archaeologists have long been intrigued by the presence of monumental architecture during this early agrarian era, because unusually, it predates the appearance of pottery in the region. Several coastal Andean sites, such as the Peruvian site of Corral, show evidence of public architecture in the form of mounds and terraced temple platforms that date from as early as 3000 BCE. This is clear evidence of coordinated labor and organization, and therefore of hierarchical social structures. While these developments were occurring along the coast, agricultural communities were also appearing in the highlands, where they domesticated tobacco and, more importantly, potatoes, which, if eaten in sufficient quantities, can provide all the nutrition that humans need. They also domesticated guinea pigs for food and their pelts, as well as two members of the camelid species, llamas for their meat and alpacas for their wool. Pottery first appeared in the Peruvian coastal and highland regions around 2000 BCE, a technological innovation that might have been associated with a shift away from a dependence on marine resources to a heavier reliance on agrarian production, and thus the need for better storage. Long-distance trade also played an important role in these early societies, with trade networks stretching up and down the coast of Peru and Ecuador. Trade routes also connected the coastal regions to the highlands. Obsidian and potatoes were exported from the hills to the coast in exchange for shells, fish, and other maritime resources. But the question of whether there were any long-distance trade and exchange contacts between these early Andean societies and contemporary societies in Mesoamerica is a vexed one. Some sort of contact must have occurred because the cultivation of corn and squashes gradually spread from Mesoamerica to the Andes, while gold, silver, and copper metallurgy and tobacco spread north into Mesoamerica. But these exchanges were limited by the challenging geography and environment that separated Central from South America, and also by the fact that megafaunal extinctions during the Paleolithic era meant that there were no real pack animals available. These limitations were destined to have profound historical ramifications, as we will soon see. Geographical barriers continue to be a factor in the region even today, as evidenced by the fact that the Pan-American Highway is still unfinished at the Panama-Colombian border. The bulldozers simply cannot make it through the swamps and mountains. The first clear archaeological evidence that one of these early agrarian Andean communities had evolved into a state is found at the site of Chavin de Huanta. Situated 3,000 feet up in the mountains, the town of Chavin emerged around 1000 BCE, flourished between 800 and 500, and then had faded by 300 BCE. Chavin may have started as a ceremonial center before evolving into a small town-state with flat-topped pyramid temples built around a central U-shaped plaza. This reminds us that one of the key reasons that explains why some villages evolved into towns all over the world was that they were regarded as having special sacred significance. As the site became more important, extensive building and expansion of the ceremonial core occurred until Chavin was supporting a population of perhaps 3,000 people. As well as a ceremonial center, Chavin also functioned as a trading hub, and several Chavin artistic styles diffused widely throughout the region, particularly the representation of a humanoid jaguar figure that appears carved in stone and on high-value goods like textiles and gold. After the demise of Chavin, several large town-states of up to 10,000 people emerged in the Andes, also with impressive public buildings constructed around ceremonial plazas, surrounded by residential districts. These town-states controlled regions stretching from the coast up through lowland valleys and on to the highlands. Each ecological niche contributed its own agrarian products to the state. Coastal populations provided fish, cotton and sweet potatoes, lowland valley farmers provided corn, beans and squash, and the highlanders offered potatoes, llama meat and alpaca wool. This is a classic example of how, by utilizing the wide diversity of ecosystems within a state, communities are able to grow enough food to sustain growing populations and complex social structures. One of the most famous of these states is Nazca, renowned for the extensive linear and zoomorphic designs they constructed in the desert, some of them several miles long. The Nazca people lived along the dry southern coast of Peru and flourished between 100 and 800 of the Common Era. Although we know something about their lifeways and religions, the purpose of their designs, known as the Nazca Lines, remains a mystery. Archaeologists believe they have worked out how these lines were made. By extending a rope between posts in the earth and removing all the red desert pebble under the rope, neat lines of lighter color are created. And because they were drawn in a hyper-arid desert, there was little danger of rainfall washing them away. Some theories about their purpose: they were meant to be viewed by the gods from above. They were astronomical alignments to help determine agricultural cycles, or they marked pathways for people to follow during important rituals. Back in the 1970s, another theory was widely circulated in a popular book. These were markings made by or intended for use by aliens visiting our planet. While that has been resoundingly debunked, there is still no agreement on the purpose they served. Another important regional state that thrived in the first millennium was that of the Mochica, who flourished between 300 and 700 CE in the valley of the Moche and other rivers along a 250-mile-wide stretch of coast. With no writing, the beliefs of the Mochicans remain difficult to determine, but they did leave behind a fascinating glimpse into their lifeways in the form of superb ceramics that depict almost all aspects of life in Moche times: farming, hunting, warfare, weaving, and sex. Our understanding of Moche political structures was enhanced by the discovery of what appear to be royal tombs at the site of Sipan in 1987. Prior to this discovery, the Moche were regarded as a complex chiefdom, but the tombs, which are rich with valuable grave goods and human sacrificial victims, suggest a much higher level of power may have been held by the Mochica rulers. Moche populations were sustained by marine resources and successful highland farming. But given the nature of the environment, this has always been tenuous, and in the end, a series of severe droughts between 562 and 594, followed by earthquakes and then torrential El Niño rains, destroyed the viability of the Mochica culture. How many times have we seen this in a big history analysis of states and civilizations? The challenges of the environment simply proved too great for human resources to overcome, and the Moche state quickly crashed and disappeared. Towards the end of the first millennium CE, new states established themselves in the highlands, like the Wari, who ruled from a mountain city called Ayacucho, and the Tiwanuku, who ruled from their capital at Lake Titicaca. Living at a lower altitude, the Wari were able to grow corn. The Tiwanaku, at an altitude above 10,000 feet, were limited to a staple of potatoes and their domesticated herds of alpacas and llamas. About 1050 CE, the climate entered a dry spell that lasted for centuries. This led to economic stress that undermined faith in religion and government, and both states simply withered away. Two centuries later, a new group of people from the Lake Titicaca region settled in a town called Cuzco at the very high altitude of 13,000 feet above sea level. These Inca people were just one of a dozen different ethnic groups living around Cuzco, and as population densities in the region increased, so too did conflict over land. Eventually, the groups reached a settlement which involved Inca chiefs marrying noble women of other groups to form coalitions. With their homeland secure, the Inca then embarked upon a series of expansionary campaigns that were begun in 1438 by the great Inca ruler Pachacuti, the Earthshaker. They were completed by his grandson 25 years later. Pachacuti retired to Cuzco, where he designed the system of government the Incas would use to rule their empire, and also built Cuzco into a magnificent city fit to be an imperial capital. By the time the Inca expansion ended in the 1490s, their empire stretched for 2,500 miles down the western coasts and highlands of South America, from the modern city of Quito in Ecuador all the way south to Santiago in Chile. This was by far the largest agrarian civilization established in the Americas, an empire that was divided into 80 administrative provinces and which contained a population of some 10 million people. It was one of the most impressive agrarian civilizations anywhere in the world in the 15th century. The Inca grouped their provinces into four geographic territories, which they called suyu. The empire was called Tahuatan Suyu, which means four parts together. They symbolized the unity of the four parts by constructing four grand highways that radiated out from the capital, Cuzco, a word that fittingly means navel, the navel of the Inca world. The divine emperor who owned all the land, livestock, and property in the realm was believed to be a direct descendant of the creator god Viracocha and the son of the sun god Inti. Once an Inca ruler died, his body was mummified. It was then kept in a house as if it were still alive, with servants to take care of the deceased ruler's needs. The dead rulers were brought out to sit at high-level decision-making councils so that state policy was always discussed in their presence. In a unique variation on the tribute-taking structure that characterized every agrarian civilization on the planet, rather than extract material tribute from the people, the Inca state extracted service in the form of mita. To fulfill the obligations of mita, all commoners plowed, planted, and harvested government and religious lands, as well as land that was allocated to them to feed their families. The staple foods grown by Inca farmers were potatoes, beans, quinoa, peppers, and corn, although the latter was more difficult to cultivate, so it was reserved to feed armies and royal households and to make beer. The Inca were master potato farmers, developing through artificial selection hundreds of different varieties. They also learned how to freeze-dry them to store for extended periods. Growing these crops on steep mountainsides required the construction of elaborate terraces, not unlike those that Chinese farmers had also learned to build. They looked like a series of green strips built step-like one above the other and kept in place by stone walls. As part of the Mita system, Inca women were also responsible for weaving textiles, and they made some of the finest textiles ever created. If they weren't farming, men often worked on state building projects, cutting and accurately fitting huge blocks of stone without mortar. Using this highly skilled labor force, the Inca were able to construct more than 20,000 miles of roads, many of them 12 feet wide, and all linked together very much like a modern interstate system. While the common people provided skilled labor, the elite stored surplus produce to be distributed during times of natural disaster. The provincial governors were obliged to hold elaborate feasts for the people, complete with massive consumption of food and drink. Thus, the powerful and other members of the elites took care of the common people while making sure to maintain their own status in the rigidly hierarchical system. The Inca had no written language as we understand the term, but they did develop a sophisticated form of record keeping that involved quipu, which were knotted strings. It took years to master the quipu system, because the meaning of the information that the strings conveyed depended on the type of knots in them, their positions on the strings, the color of each string, and the position of the string on the main cord from which it emanated. The Inca religion was presided over by priests who came from elite families and devoted themselves to celibacy. The Inca worshipped the sun god Inti and the moon goddess Mama Quila. In Cuzco, they built temples to the sun and the moon, much as the inhabitants of Central America's Teotihuacan had done with pyramids centuries before them. Male priests supervised rituals in the Temple of the Sun, while priestesses did the same in the Temple of the Moon. Gold was regarded as the sweat of the sun, and silver the tears of the moon. For the Inca, their stunning mountain highland and coastal landscapes were sacred and active places. Mountains were revered as a source of rainfall and water, and were propitiated with sacrifices of valuable goods and llamas high upon mountain peaks. On very special occasions, particularly beautiful children were also sacrificed. But this was rare, and human sacrifices never came close to the scale of Aztec sacrifices. Anthropologists have discovered a few shamans who, even today, continue to practice Inca religious beliefs in high mountain areas, which remain relatively untouched by Spanish culture. Another reminder of Inca civilization found high in the Andes today is the Inca masterwork Machu Picchu, the stunning outpost discovered in 1911 by archaeologist Hiram Bingham. Machu Picchu means old peak, and it was most probably a vacation retreat for several generations of Inca rulers. At an altitude of 8,000 feet, Machu Picchu was lower and warmer than Cuzco, and it provided a royal haven that was never detected by the Spanish when they arrived early in the 16th century, bringing to an abrupt end the extraordinary Inca Empire. Machu Picchu was therefore never besieged, but it appears to have been abandoned around the time of the Spanish invasion. The coasts and mountains of the Andean regions are not the only places in South America where complex states appeared. The work of archaeologists over the past few decades has also revealed chiefdom-level societies in parts of the Amazon basin. The Amazon River system is huge, of course, providing about 20% of all the fresh water that flows into the world's oceans through a mouth that is 200 miles wide. The Amazon drains about 40% of the total area of South America, and the warm equatorial climate of the basin means that around 400 inches of rain falls every year. Archaeologists were not interested in Amazonia for a long time. They were focused on uncovering evidence of states and civilizations in the Andes. And evidence of human occupation of the Amazon basin was much more difficult to locate, given the dense vegetation, the shifting river channels, and the hot, humid climate. Only in the 1970s did archaeologists begin to examine Amazonia, and ever since they have been engaged in a vigorous debate about the meaning of what they have found there. So the story we can tell about humans in Amazonia remains somewhat vague at the moment, although there is no doubt that some parts were occupied by human farming communities long before the arrival of Europeans, with their deadly diseases that drove the inhabitants back to foraging. What we do know is that Amazon farmers were growing manioc, sweet potatoes, and squash, supplemented by fish and other river resources from as early as 5000 BCE. And by 2000 BCE, agrarian villages had been established, some of which evolved into complex societies. Between 1000 and 1500 of the Common Era, the last half millennium before European contact, some Amazonian communities constructed earthen mounds and walls. These societies were structured as chiefdoms rather than states. Power was consensual, and there was no attempt to collect coerced tributes. Let's consider three such societies on a journey up the Amazon. Our first stop is Mario Island in the mouth of the Amazon, where a society known as the Marioara developed. With no stones to work with, Marioara architecture consisted of ceremonial earthen mounds up to 22 feet high, constructed around a central plaza. The oldest mounds date to around 400 of the Common Era, and clearly this was a successful society because the Marioara were able to keep constructing these mounds for about 1,000 years. 150 miles upstream from Mario Island, we come to Santarem, an impressive settlement built by the Tapio people on a bluff above the Tapios River. The first European explorers in Amazonia were astonished by Santarem, which they described as a great white city. Excavations indicate that Santarem might have been as large as 10 square miles in area, as large and impressive as Teotihuacan in Mesoamerica or Cahokia in the Mississippi Valley. 150 miles upriver again, we arrive at Acutuba, a large town of 75 acres near the modern Brazilian city of Manaus. Acutuba had a huge central plaza the size of more than three football fields, surrounded on three of its sides by sculpted earthen walls more than 33 feet high. Given the size of the plaza, archaeologists wonder if Acutuba was a regional ceremonial center serving a network of towns rather than an individual city, particularly as historical records indicate that important trade items used to be found in the city, like gold, precious gems, bird feathers, salt, and medicinal plants. The establishment of these and other extensive communities that supported dense populations is a testament to the creative skill of Amazonian farmers, given the notoriously poor soil of the region. The red soil has its nutrients washed out by the torrential rains, leaving it highly acidic. Plants of the region cope with this problem by absorbing the leaching nutrients in their roots. Then they die and fall to the ground, and new roots grow directly out of the fallen, nutrient-rich vegetation. Humans came up with a different approach by burning trees into charcoal, then mixing the charcoal pieces with fecal waste, with fish and turtle bones, and with vegetable waste. They created what is known as terra preta, or black earth, which they spread out to form farming plots. Many of these ancient black earth fields can still be identified today, like the black earth fields of Santarem that are an enormous 3 miles long and half a mile wide. In addition to the black earth fields, some archaeologists believe that a significant percentage of the forest in Amazonia are actually ancient orchards of fruit and nut trees, further testament to the creative genius of the former farmers of this harsh environment. It is extraordinary now to remember that not that long ago, historians described the Western Hemisphere before 1492 as a vast wilderness in which small-scale foraging bands eked out a precarious existence, and only in Mesoamerica and the Andes was there any glimmer of civilization. Now we understand that the reason that early human populations in the Americas seemed so small and scattered when they were first assessed is because European diseases like smallpox had killed up to 90% of the original inhabitants. What European explorers discovered were just the remnants of what once had been. Today we know that the two great continents of the Americas and the long isthmus that connects them were home to untold millions of humans and to two of the most impressive agrarian civilizations that ever developed on the planet, every bit as complex and fascinating as those in Afro-Eurasia. Thick historians realize just how fortunate we are that human society developed independently in the Americas without any significant contact with other areas of the world until 1492, because it allows us to compare the evolution of states and civilizations in these two vast world zones. It really is quite remarkable just how many common experiences these societies shared given their isolation from each other. In both zones, humans initially lived as foragers, but then made the transition to agriculture so successfully that increased populations and resources led inevitably to the appearance of early states. In places where the Goldilocks conditions were just right, Tenochtitlan in central Mexico and the coasts and highlands of the Andes, some states evolved into fully developed agrarian civilizations. And these shared a long list of common features with civilizations in Afro-Eurasia: monumental architecture, powerful leaders, armies and warfare, writing systems, and networks of exchange. But there are equally remarkable differences. American civilizations lacked the power to extract the levels of tribute or enforced coercion that their counterparts across Afro-Eurasia were able to do, which meant they could never achieve the same sort of stability or longevity. Despite the fact that historians woefully underestimated the population of the Americas, it was still much, much smaller than the population of Afro-Eurasia, perhaps making up less than 10% of the global population by the year 1000 CE, compared to the Afro-Eurasian share of close to 90%. Another difference, and this is the most critical of all, is the comparative size of trade and exchange networks in the two world zones. We have seen that Mesoamerican networks reached from Central America a long way north to the Mississippi River, evidenced by the spread of the Mesoamerican invention of corn agriculture. And we have considered tenuous links between the Andean and Mesoamerican regions, maintained not so much by land, but perhaps by the use of large ocean-going canoes. We know that well-built canoes once glided the length of the rivers of eastern North America and of the Amazon basin, and also along both coasts of Central America. Indeed, the Maya had dug out canoes that could hold 50 people. Caribbean peoples also built ocean-going canoes, as did the Chincha along the Peruvian coast. So canoe technology was probably used to link ancient American states and civilizations into a loosely interacting exchange network. But again, these American exchange networks were much smaller and much less diverse than those of Afro-Eurasia. Just think of the Silk Roads, a massive network of trade and exchange linking all of the great civilizations then operating in Eurasia with foragers, with small-scale farmers, and great confederations of pastoralists, all connected into a single, incredibly diverse system. Matters of scale and timing like this really matter in the big history of the world, because when the two world zones collided after 1492 with the arrival of Columbus, and soon after him, the conquistadors, the societies of the Afro-Eurasian zone quickly came to utterly dominate the societies of the Americas. They were able to use their horses, their weapons, their armor, and their knowledge to grab hold of the fabulous resources they discovered in the Americas and use these to help finance their takeover of the rest of the world. For the states and civilizations of the Americas, this was an unmitigated disaster. The conquest of their lands by the superior technology and deadly diseases of Europeans meant that their trajectories were cut brutally short. We can only imagine what diverse and remarkable forms these civilizations would have evolved into, given their foundations and their history. And we can only speculate on how radically different the story might have been had American civilizations had the time to reach their full potential, so that the clash of the two world zones was a more even contest. Can you picture how the subsequent history of the world might have unfolded if the Europeans had not been able to defeat the Aztecs and Incas and thus not acquire their wealth to finance their subsequent colonization of the planet?